This is Gordon Keating, 16th of October, 1995, Alchemy and Healing.
The first thing I want to say really is, that I'm very pleased to have been asked by the Jung Society to come and speak. I think this is a wonderful place to speak. There's usually a great audience and a really fun audience to talk to. I also want to thank all of you for coming tonight and engaging in this. I'd like to think of it as a conversation. It'll be kind of one way, but we'll have discussion too. But if you can think of it, even though I'm mostly talking, be with me like you're in a conversation. I mean, people do that anyway. You know, you're having your own thoughts and wonderings and so on, but that's good. Because I hope that we're kind of looking at something here in a spirit of inquiry, and that it's not just about, you know, some kind of answers that are right. I don't think that takes us into this territory of alchemy and transformation and soul, because I don't think the soul has a lot of concern about necessarily what's true and false. That's another part of us that is really concerned about that. Tonight, really, I think I like to look at ideas from the point of view about whether they enhance people's lives and my life, or whether they maybe detract from it. You could also say, is it healthy or is it unhealthy? Something like that. Before I start, I did want to ask, how many people were here for either the lecture or the workshop of Stephen Heller? Would you just raise your hand? So a good many, but there's also a significant number of people that weren't here. I really consider that I'm going to be, in some ways, building on what he talked about and what he said. I will do my best to sort of make sure that I include those of you who weren't at his talk, and because I know there's a significant number of you that didn't hear his talk. As Paul said, the theme for tonight is the alchemy of healing. And I wrote that, and I wrote the description some time ago, before I knew what I was really going to say, as is often the case with these things. But the title still fits, and I'm a physician, so, you know, I'm in the healing profession and so on, and this word healing is a word that's really pretty much in vogue. And actually, to tell you the truth, the word has always been pretty perplexing to me. I think it's a tricky word, but that's okay. But let me just throw out to you some notions of healing, and then we'll be talking more about these in depth, some of them at least. There's one idea of healing, which is the notion of making something whole. I haven't looked at this a long time, but if you look up the roots of the word heal, they do go back to words that mean to make whole or something like that. So that's one of the notions of healing. There's also certainly the notion of healing as a transformation. And that is very close to what we're talking about in this whole alchemical series, because as Dr. Heller pointed out, that alchemical process, the steps, and he went through that in quite a bit of detail, is concerned with bringing a new whole, a new creation into being. So it's certainly transformation. There's healing as transformation. And then there's also the notion of healing as a balance. If you're out of balance, you know, then you could get back in balance. And that, I think, ties in very well with alchemy, because in alchemy, you know, there's this concern about the opposites, that you have to bring into the alchemical vessel, the opposites, and there's a tension of those opposites. And I think, as Dr. Heller pointed out very well, the tendency in life a lot of times is to avoid this altogether. It's easier just to avoid the conflict, push one side under, and then you get very unbalanced. So to bring in both parts of it, and then somehow make a creative balance out of these opposites. That's another very valid notion of healing. Really, I think healing, if you look at, I think Dr. Heller basically said this, that alchemy is a symbolic paradigm of transformation of the personality or of individuation. And we'll talk more about that and parts of that, but I think that is profoundly connected with healing. I think these, in some ways, it's hard to imagine healing, for me anyway, without individuation, without some kind of transformative aspect to it. Although, I was thinking before here about healing a little bit. Now these are two examples from the trivial to the profound. The trivial thing is you've got a sliver in your foot and you can't get it out, and someone helps you and you take out the sliver, and that's healing. And in a way, it is. I mean, it's the most simple case, incredibly simple. And then you're fine, and you go off, and you're happy. Now, other cases of healing are very profound. A person is on their deathbed, and in the process of dying, a shift occurs in their entire world, the way they see the world. Maybe they begin to forgive people they haven't forgiven. Their relationships change. The way their life looks to them change. It's like a total transformation, and they die the next day. So, you see, there's lots of different levels of healing, from the seemingly trivial of the sliver in your foot or something to this sort of transformation that could occur in somebody while they're actually dying, and it doesn't mean they would miraculously survive or something like that. But there's also healings like that, too, of sort of spontaneous cures and remarkable recoveries. And I think those have to do with some kind of transformative process, and that may become clearer as I talk. Another question, well, one question that comes up a lot about healing that I'm not talking about, I think the answer is pretty easy to that one, and that is, like, who does the healing? Because there's the notion of a healer, and some people kind of give a magical quality to a healer and attribute the healing to the powers of the healer and so on. My personal bias is not that way at all. I think it's something inside of us, the self, if you want to call it that, or whatever, that is the healer. But then a question comes up, what is healed? Or I guess you could say, what is transformed to? And there's a lot of answers to that. If you think about it, people talk about the soul being healed. Certainly the body is healed. I suppose you could talk about the ego, some kind of healing process in the ego. Dr. Heller mentioned last time, I thought this was good, the transformation of the ego involves, it looks sometimes like it involves the end of the ego or the destruction of the ego. I'll say more about that. But really, he just said it's like the reduction of the ego. But in a funny way, it's like the reduction of the ego at the same time as it's the expansion of the ego. It's a very odd thing. Both things are sort of happening. And what else? Well, sometimes people even talk about the spirit being healed. Certainly the mind healed. Attitudes, attitudinal healing. I'm going to propose that a very good thing to think about being healed would be memory. Because memory is really the way we carry the past. And if a shift occurs in the way that we carry the past, that may be a healing. So I think that's a useful thing to think about. And actually, I would say a lot of work is being done now on memory. There's a lot of interest in it, partially because of the focus on the effect of trauma on people. And the quote, new diagnosis of post-traumatic stress, which isn't a new diagnosis at all. That was well known, you know, back in the last century, that phenomena and descriptions of it were made. But it's where people experience something very traumatic and then they have nightmares or intrusive memories of that particular situation. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. That's not the major focus I have here, but it brings up a lot of interesting questions about memory, about how when people are in traumatic situations, and this really would include all of us because we all have some kind of trauma, that one of the things that we know how to do is to dissociate from what is happening, which means that you kind of go out of your body. And the difficulty with that is that that's probably adaptive at the moment. I mean, certainly if somebody is having some terrible, painful thing happen to them, that makes sense. But it's still registered in the body. So, see, memory then, and in that case, it's kind of a problematic registered in the body a lot of times. It's registered in the body without it really having been incorporated into the person's story of their life and into their own mental schema. It just exists there as this kind of raw experience that's suppressed. And again, in these traumatic memory situations, parts of that tend to leak into the present. And that is a very literal kind of memory sometimes. I mean, people will start having sensations that they had when the trauma occurred, or they'll start having flashbacks of pictures, visual pictures of it, or they'll start doing something that they were doing at the time, but it's not all connected. Any of those things could happen. It's a very dysfunctional kind of memory, really, if you think about it. It's literal memory, but it's not integrated. So, people, you know, here's an interesting thing, too. I was talking about the man who dies on his deathbed and his relationships are transformed. And usually when something like that happens, is he the only one that's healed? I don't think so. In a certain way, the world is healed. So there's some kind of connection here. This is not just about us as individuals. There's something bigger that goes on when you have a transformation or a healing, because it isn't just the individual themselves that's healed, it's the world. And I'll say a little bit more about that, too. Okay, those comments are sort of by way of introduction. I think I'm going to try sitting a little bit here. If any of you have trouble hearing me, or if in the course of my talking, some lack of clarity there, or you really want to ask a question, that's okay. We will have a chance later to talk more about it and reflect on it. But I'd like to make some remarks about transformation and about the alchemical process of transformation, which Dr. Heller told us about a couple weeks ago and in a lot of detail. I'm not going to go into all the detail that he did there, but actually I want to emphasize a couple of points. One point I want to emphasize is the one that he said several times and said it needs to be emphasized. And it does need to be emphasized because it's that when we're talking about transformation, we are not talking about normal change. Normal change is just happens. You put a boat out into Puget Sound and it will go somewhere. It will drift. Everything is changing. That's the nature of life. You know, everything is changing. And mostly it's sort of a predictable, continuous sort of change. And as Dr. Heller said, this transformational change that the alchemists were interested in is radical change. It's discontinuous change. And it's also change which is not just rearranging parts. I mean, the boat drifting somewhere is probably in that category. I mean, something just got a little bit rearranged. It's a change, but not what we're talking about here. So we're talking about this discontinuous radical change. And I would also use the term holistic change, because what's going on is that the whole of something is changing. I don't mean the whole of everything is changing. I'm not saying that. But the whole of something is changing. So we're talking about holistic change when we're talking about transformation. And Dr. Heller brought out the fact that because the ego, which is sort of, I'm using that pretty much like Jung uses it, I think, it's a kind of a complex of different patterns and behavior patterns and different aspects of the self that are really seen as like an identity. And it's from the past. That's what Dr. Heller said, and I agree. It's totally shaped and molded by what has already been known, what has already happened. It's by the past. And it also has a tendency, this ego, to want to think of itself as a completed entity. Something that's finished. Now, that doesn't work real well in life because, you know, we're in this sort of dynamic process. So the ego then has to go to quite a bit of lengths to try to maintain this illusion that it's complete. But it isn't like a becoming. It doesn't see itself like something becoming. It sees itself more like something fixed. And I don't know if even to talk about it quite like it sees itself. There's some funny language there. I wish I could find another way of talking about it, but because that's sort of the function of the ego. We're talking about the functional qualities of it and what it does. So anyway, and you've heard the expression ego alien. Well, maybe you haven't. It's kind of a term. When something shows up in a person's ego system that doesn't fit in that system, so there's a tendency to, it upsets the person, might make them anxious, or they just reject it or whatever. Well, transformation is sort of like the invasions of the aliens, you know, to the ego. Because transformation would involve like a big change in something, some aspect of this ego self. So it's really, from the point of view of the ego, it would look like an invasion of aliens. And so if you think about that, you might wonder how on earth any transformation ever occurs, which is a valid consideration, but it occurs because there's something else going on here. Number one is there's something more than the known that's flowing from the past. Namely, that there's something coming from the future. Now, I'm going to go into that more. This is now new. This is not part of what Dr. Heller talked about, but I think this fits in alchemy, and I'll go into it more. The other thing is, there's something more than the ego, I say, which is like an active sense of I, which is in the present, and which is connecting us. It's a function. It's not an entity. Like the ego is an entity, and that the sense of I that I'm talking about is a function. It's a function of awareness. That's one of its functions. Maybe it has other functions of choice and so on too, but the central one maybe to see here is this function of awareness. I want to quote to you from this book, and also I'm going to be using this book quite a bit in this talk. This is really a profound book, in my opinion. It's not an easy book, but it's wonderful. It's called Love and the Soul, and it's by a man named Robert Sardello. The subtitle here is called Creating a Future for Earth. He has written another book. Doug has some of these out there on the table. But he's written another book that's now in paperback called Facing the World with Soul, which is also a really interesting book, too, that preceded this one. Anyway, I want to quote to you what he says in here about ego. The ego is always oriented toward the past, toward trying to hold on to what it has received from the past. Thus, the ego acts like a finished structure of consciousness, one that is complete. But since it is really not complete, it must continually seek affirmation that it is by acting like an is. You get that? It acts like it's an is, because that makes it feel complete. That is his contrast to a becoming. So that's a distinction that I might say just a little bit more about. I think it's an incredibly useful distinction. I've heard this before, but it's like the ego's world is an is world. It's like already a certain way. Life is a certain way. Things are a certain way. So you could call it the already always about the way life is. It's an is world. It's not an evolving, it's not a becoming world, it's not a transforming world. It's an is world. I'm going to quote a little more on this, but I want to wait because I want to show you this diagram. Some of you might have seen me drawing this. I hope this is going to make this a little bit clearer. I called this a diagram of transformation. I'm not quite sure that's exactly right, but it shows something that I want you to see. And so remember, we've already talked about the fact that we're now going to talk about like there's two rivers of time. One river of time is flowing from the past into the future. This is a very dominant focus of all of psychology, has tended to focus a great deal on this, about how this that happened to us in the past is determining how we're going to be in the future and so on. But Sardello, and he didn't invent this himself, I don't know who invented it originally, but he got it from Rudolf Steiner, who said, there's another flow of time, and that other flow of time is coming from the future toward us and into the past. Now, that might seem like a foreign notion, but I think if you just think a little bit about yourself and about how you live, we don't really think like so much about how we're coming out of the past. I don't think. I mean, we might think about that, but when we're actually living, it's much more like we're living into something. You see, and that's the future. Now, the problem is that the future that we're living into may not be an open future, a future with all possibilities in it. It may be a future that's pretty much shaped by the past. So, but it's a different, but there is the possibility of the future that's coming at us that is. See, what's the difference here? Well, this is the known. This is the already always. This is also where the ego is. And I put object here because the ego treats itself like an object. I mean, it's an entity. It's an object. And then the is world, which is, by the way, sort of a world of objects too, or at least a fixed world, okay? So over here is the unknown. Another word, a good word would be possible. And self is possibility and world is possibility. Okay? Very different here. Now, this, it's hard to grasp the unknown because, you know, it's not like you know certain things that you don't know. I mean, there's lots of things you don't know. I know lots of things I don't know. But do you know the things that you don't know that you don't know you don't know? Yeah, so see, you don't know the things. You don't, we're talking here about what you don't know that you don't know even. I mean, this is like totally, you're totally in the dark. I mean, I don't know how to make an atomic bomb, but I guess I could go and try to find out how to make one and something like that. See, I mean, like, I know I don't know that. That's different. That's not what this is. That would be sort of like, this isn't just potential. Potential is actually something more over here. Because potential is like something that you say, well, I have a certain potential and I could project that into the future and so on. This is also not prediction. See, over here, there are things that happen about the future, like prediction. And actually, control. Prediction and control, those are really important things over here, in which the ego is attempting to make the future fit what it already is. See? So prediction and control are important for that. But that's not the future. None of that's not the future. That's all over here. That's not the unknown future. Anyway, that's the future as the past. Okay. Oh, then I have to say something about this, because this is not a totally new idea to me from this book, because there's some other things that I'm going to mention too where I got this. But this is an important contribution here, and that is what he's calling the sense of I. And that operates right there. Can you imagine? Here are these two things, these rivers of the known and the unknown, and they're crashing into each other. I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing to think about. And at that place where they meet, that's really the place of awareness. And that's where this sense of the I operates. And the qualities of the sense of I are pretty interesting. It's not bound. It has a certain great deal of flexibility and freedom. It doesn't fixate itself in anything. It's moving around. It's not aware of itself, really. That's what he says, and I think that's right. It's just, it's aware of its experience. It's that part of us that is knowing that we're there, and it gives us a sense of continuity in life. And what I'm going to say about that, and you know, this might be a little controversial, but I think it's a pretty good connection, is that in the alchemical system, that's Mercurius. And Mercurius is seen as this, in the alchemical system, as this force that kind of comes down and helps to resolve the polarity between the opposites. But Mercurius has the qualities of movement and of not being stuck in any one place. It has those qualities. So the thing is, then, that I like about this is we're talking about the sense of I. That's not like some thing that we hope comes out of the heavens, you know, and will help us out when we're stuck with something. It's something that we have available to us that really, to put it in terms of Jungian psychology, I would say is part of the self. It's actually the action of the self in the moment. I think that would be, it's a function. It's not an entity, it's a function. And awareness is probably its main function, but there might be other ones. Now, this is the same diagram, except I wanted to show something else. And I don't know if this is going to be clear or not, or even if this is kind of... I'd be interested in your feedback about this later or at any time. I'm interested in your feedback on that, too, but... So here we have the same thing. This is the thing of the future. This is the time, future time flowing in, and this is past time. And they're meeting at this point. And what I'm trying to show here is, in a way, there's a figure eight here. Okay? And this could be, like, what's moving around this figure eight is the sense of the eye, awareness. And there's something interesting that's happening here, because one of the things that's very interesting about the unknown is that as soon as you've moved into the unknown, where is it going to go?
Into the past.
Into the past. Exactly. So you can't keep something like that, really. It tends to just automatically go back into the past, and that's what this really shows here. So here, this F over F means future is the future. which is like really the unknown. Okay. And then, but once that starts to get incorporated, it comes back and it goes into the past. And then this would be past as the past. And I've for here I put envision, because that seems to me a word that kind of fits how we sort of reach for the unknown in a certain way. And then you come back here, and then you have remember. And then and that's the past is the past. You're moving toward the past. You're remembering. You're moving toward the past. And you're in the past, so to speak. Then here, you're starting to move again toward the future. The movement here is back toward the future. But you're still in the past. And I don't know about that. That occurred to me as one possibility. This is a place of inquiry, okay? And then you go back into envision, and there might be some vision there, and then a new, assuming you pass this point, we'll deal with that in a minute, because in life you may never pass this point. It's possible to just live over on this side of this and never get to this side. I also think it might be possible to live on this side and shut this side out, which doesn't work either. I'll say something about both of those. So anyway, you have this figure eight. Now,
On your top of your little, does it say future?
Future as the future. Yeah, future is the future, future is the past. So here's, this is interesting. I don't know if this is right either. So you're getting out here, you've got this great possibility of something new, and it's gone. We forgot it. Think about the creative process. It's kind of like that. And the way anything gets established in the world, it's forgotten thousands of times until it's finally there, and then we don't forget it because it's so much a part of the past. But when it's coming in, and when it's something new coming in, there's a lot of forgetting that goes on, and remembering over and again, forgetting and remembering. So I know that that's kind of the way something new comes into being. So this fits for me in that respect. I drew this part as very large and this part is very small because I think in practice that's the way it is. We're going around this figure eight, but we're much more over here and just a little bit over here. Now, if you don't cross this point, then you get into a sort of a closed loop. And that's, if it was up to the ego alone, it would just be in this closed loop and nothing, there wouldn't be any movement. It would just be stuck. The question was about, could this model apply to cultures? And I haven't really thought about that, so I don't really know the answer, but it ties into Sardello's basic idea that there isn't really a separation between our soul and the soul of the world that he talks about. So, and what one of the conditions that we're in right now is that we don't see any soul in the world. And everybody's thinking, well, I better go and do therapy and explore myself and try to find my inner soul. And he is critiquing that approach. And personally, it fits my own bias. I think one of the biggest problems I have had with a lot of personal, fascinating personal exploration of working with dreams and so on, is that I have had trouble getting what I got from that to connect with the world that I'm living in. So there's a split there, and I think you know, it's not. I mean, Sardello is this book is actually a critique of depth psychology, not just Jungian psychology, but depth psychology, and it's a profound critique in my view. I mean, I think he's pointing us toward a new paradigm that we need to look at. And that's one of the kind of radical parts of it. Maybe it's radical, maybe it's not, but anyway, since I put up this model here, and it's kind of right here now, does anybody have any question about it or any comment?
I kind of like to label the middle point.
Ecstatic spontaneity, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because in a sense, in the past,
well, it kind of goes back to your point about this point is a kind of a very special point in this situation for a number of reasons, because it's where the future meets the past, really, these rivers. Now, the other thing to think about this diagram is that this diagram, even though it looks kind of dynamic, it's got arrows going, but remember that there's a flowing of the time. There's the flowing of the time here and the flowing of the time here. So it's a dynamic system that way, too. You can't really show that.
Yeah, it sounds like driving a car. You see where you're going on the highway, but you're looking in the rear view mirror. And so it depends on the perspective you have here. Focusing on the rear view mirror, you see where you're going.
Right.
If you're focusing on the goals, you see them.
Yes. Very good. And one reason why I like this diagram is that certainly all of these are legitimate kind of things. I mean, these are our capacities that we have as human beings, the capacity to remember. And we're going to talk more about that because it's not just a sort of remembering of something like an incident that happened in the past. It's like a recollection of all of creation, virtually. I mean, it's possible, because the body, for example, our body is like this reservoir of everything, really, that's happened from a particular, for our individuality, that's true. And an inquiry, and all these are functions. Somebody else back?
Yeah, I had a question, because you say that that's static, but I saw it leading to this, so that it was sort of like this.
Right. This is not what it's meant to show. The only thing I can say is that where it would be static if it never moved past here. And then the other thing is, these are like, you're going around here and there's transformation, and then you're moving on and there's another transformation, and then you're moving on and there's another transformation, and this is kind of the way that happens. But if you don't move into the unknown, if you don't ever go into this realm of the future, then I say there's no transformation. But the model is trying to show that, but its diagrams are limiting.
I wonder if part of that is, if we refer back to the Rosario that Dr. Heller presented, the stages about transformation. And so much of the focus is on the nigredo, is on the mortification,
yes,
the putrefatio, and I think to some extent that's the realm of the past.
Yes.
And you get this little bit of whitening and a little bit of that time in the red.
Yes.
And my sense is that's something of the movement into the future, but the bulk of it does lie in that place of the blackening.
Yeah, that's clear. Yeah, I think that fits with very well.
Well, the center point is the point of a reality at the moment.
I'll go over standby you, because I realize I haven't been repeating the question. He asked me to repeat the question. I think if you talk now, it'll show in here.
That center point is what is arising at the moment. And our consciousness arises with the objects in our environment. In being spontaneous at the reacting to those is a natural condition, but as soon as the mind takes over and we associate it with the past or project it into the future, we're off center. But in a sense, it's a dynamic spot, but it's also static simultaneously because it is currently here and it's not going anywhere.
Uh-huh. Great, thanks. I think I'd better move on probably, but we can have more questions later. I better check and see how we're doing on the time here.
We did talk earlier about Greg Bell. I'll let you pick a time and say between now and quarter of 9 and you want to take a 15-minute break.
Okay, yeah, that should be no problem. Okay, let's see where I want to go next. We've done this. Oh, I want to read about what he says about the sense of I, because that's kind of a new idea. And those of you who listen to Dr. Heller's talk, or, you know, who've studied alchemy some, Just think about this in terms of how it relates to Mercurius. So you got to find the right page here. He says here, the eye lives in an orientation toward the time current from the future, and thus knows only awareness, but not an awareness of itself. The ego is finished, habitual, repetitive, and uncreative. The I becomes, can be imagined as a capacity rather than an entity, functions through improvisation, has no fixed form, and creates what it knows. So that's the there's more about it in the book here, but that's one way of looking at that sense of the I. I want to talk about another person whose work I've really liked and I've learned a lot from, and that I think this person has a concept that also is close to this. He calls it the aware ego, and it's a guy that's, well, it's two people, Hal and Sidra Stone, who've developed something called voice dialogue, and they wrote several books, and one of their books is out there, it's called Embracing Yourselves. And the notion there is that we have this multiplicity of selves. And the notion of voice dialogue, which I don't want to go into in detail, but it's a very alchemical approach. Because basically what you're doing is you're constellating in your session with the person the opposites. And you're doing that by the leader of it talks to a particular self and then talks to the opposite of that self. And ultimately the point of it is to develop the person's capacity to be in what he calls the aware ego. That is the part which can be aware of both sides at the same time, or, you know, and embrace the opposites. So that whole language, and Hal Stone, he's not a current Jungian analyst, but he that was his background and that was his training. And he obviously knows a lot about Jung and a lot about alchemy, because I could, as I've read more about alchemy, I could look at what he had come up with and see how really it was alchemical. And it also brings up a point that I think is a good one, which is that when we use techniques, either in a therapeutic context or sometimes maybe in other contexts that aren't official therapy, and these techniques, if they really are tapping into this alchemical transformative process, are powerful, and powerful things can happen. And you could see it as experiments. I kind of like that. So you ask somebody to do an experiment, and then they're relating to certain aspects of themselves in this kind of experimental way and seeing what comes out of this a sort of an interaction. I think there are other methods that would fit, too. I'm not trying to say that's the only alchemy. We pay a price. I mean, I don't believe people talk about, I think sometimes about how growth and transformation is all this terrible suffering. There is some suffering, but mostly it's, to me, mostly it's fear and the discomfort about the unknown. The suffering of transformation is nothing compared to the suffering of being stuck on in the ego on one side of this, I think. So, oh, the name of that, the best book to start off with is called Embracing Ourselves, by Hal and Sidra Stone. And he has some of them out there. They've also got a book out there I saw called Embracing Your Inner Critic, which deals with a particular part of ourselves. So anyway, that notion of the aware ego, I think, is something like this awareness of the I that Sardello is talking about. Okay. Um, I want to, this may help. I don't know. I think when we want to talk about these things, a lot of times metaphors are almost more useful than concepts. So I have some metaphors here that I like to use. I use these a lot in my work with people, and I like them. And I never thought of them so much as sort of alchemical metaphors or metaphors of soul making. See, Sardello basically says that, you know, that's what alchemy is. Alchemy is soul making. There is a creative element in it. It isn't just soul investigation, because the only way you can investigate the soul is you got to jump in there and get into it and actually generate it. So there is, if you leave out this thing from the future here, you leave out creating. It's not a possibility. And I don't think, my feeling is, in my own life, and I've worked with lots of people, this is the thing we're struggling the most with, is that we supposedly are, you know, born in the image of God in a way, and God created, so we can create. But do we really live our lives creating our lives? Unfortunately, more often it's, we live our lives reactively, same letters, they're arranged a little bit different, creatively and reactively. So to me, this touches on something. I mean, I was so thrilled to read this book because it's a subject, this issue about creating and living creatingly, that's very important to me. And now I want to get my metaphors. Okay, so these are metaphors of this transformative process or of this soul making. And one metaphor is, and I think I can remember it, but I've got some notes on it too here if I need it. One is a metaphor having to do with music. Now, lots of people think the soul and music are connected, so that's a good area to make the metaphor. And so in this case, we're talking about making orchestral music, okay? So let's look at this a little bit. Let's look at the different aspects of it. So I'm saying that, what if we said that soul making or transformation is like music making? Then, in that case, the personality, your personality, which is a little different word than ego, but anyway, that's like the orchestra. It's got these different parts. It's got the string section. It's got the percussion section and so on. And they do their own things. You know, they have particular ways of being. And then in this case, the world, we want to bring the world into it. So the world would be like the symphony hall and the audience. And this one I particularly like. The I, the aware ego, the awareness of the I is the conductor. Or the composer. I think you could go with either one of those. It's like the conductor or the composer. And of course the creation is the music that's produced in the process. And if you ask the question, well, where is the soul? The soul is the activity of making music. Or you could even say the love expressed in the music. That's the soul. Again, this is a metaphor. I'm going to use another metaphor. And my friend David is here, and I know he'll like this metaphor. I thought of even saying it's bread making, but I'm making it a little different than that, but it's close. And that is a metaphor of cooking. Okay, so cooking a wonderful meal. That's the... That's what we're working with here. So in this case, then, what's the personality? Well, the personality is the all the ingredients, all the different things that the cook is putting together. Now you already got a little bit about what the aware ego is, or the awareness of I. It would be the cook who's putting this all together. The world, of course, is the people coming to eat it and the table that it's being served on. And the creation is the prepared food. That's the creation in this creative process. And of course, the soul is the expression of love in the cooking. So I don't know if that helps, but to me, these things kind of help. They particularly are useful in sort of conveying the significance of that aware ego or that awareness of I. Because in both of those cases, the conductor, for example, needs to... The conductor can't say, oh, the strings are great and the brass are terrible. Because he has to do what the music calls for. And in life, a lot of times, this is the way we're operating. We're operating without a conductor inside. And whatever the dominant personality is in us, let's say it's a pleaser. I have to please other people and keep them happy. That determines what I do. Now, there's another side of me, which might be my assertive side or something, but maybe that's disowned. So that doesn't get to operate. Or sometimes what happens is mostly it's the pleaser, and then once in a while I go into the other side and I flip to the other side, and so then when I'm aggressive, I'm real aggressive, and my assertiveness doesn't come across very well. Because it's just a flip back and forth between the poles, and it's not... blending. It's not a putting together of those. Okay, so... There's a few more things I do want to touch on that I hope will help connect this a little bit more with alchemy. Yeah? Yeah, well, it's not so much the ego there. It's like, it is the ego. It's like a part self, like your dominant self. That's part of your ego, though. So I just use that example. If a dominant self that you have is a pleaser, then the pleaser is the conductor. Yeah, and that's only one side of it, see? Yeah. So I think I said part of this already. This alchemical work, this transformative work, is this soul-making work, is work that you cannot do without being in a creative, participatory mode. If you are just trying to explore into these things and investigate them at some distance and not allow it to... not stand in it, you see, you can't do this. It requires that you stand in the process. That's what Sardella says, and I think that's right. We protect ourselves a lot in life by being more detached and not doing that, but, and I'm not saying that that's bad, but we just need to know that it's an active participatory process. And then, you know, a good question is, if we want to be more creative, then we could say, well, what capacities do we need to develop in ourselves in order to be able to move into the unknown? See, ego isn't going to help us do that, so what is it that we need to do that? And, well, one of those things is certainly, I've talked quite a bit about, is this sense of the I think would be a capacity. That's a capacity, and we need that. I think if you look at life and look at people, you can maybe see people who've totally lost any sense of I. That's really a disaster, because they're really... totally at the effect of life. There's no sense of them directing anything. It's like another thing I kind of like about this sense of the I is I think it's useful that people live their lives from a recognition that they are the center of their world. That's another way of saying that. Now, a lot of times we aren't that way. We get knocked off center easily. But most of us, at least some of the times, in our life, are the center of our world. But if we're knocked off that, then it's like we've lost that sense of the I, and we're it's a difficulty. Another thing that I think many things would be useful for getting into the future, but one of them that seems really useful would be imagination. The capacity of imagination, which Jung was very interested in, and most Jungian psychologists are real interested in imagination. And Jung had creative imagination that he used as a method. And one thing that Sardello says about that is that, and this is some of his critique of depth psychology, is that there's too much emphasis on the results of imagination, like the contents, what one has gotten out of an imaginative process, instead of the activity of imagination. The activity of the imagination, that's different than what results you got from it. Now, he also makes a critique of our culture and points to something that I think is very problematic that we have, which is that we expose ourselves to pre-packaged results and products of other people's imagination. And it doesn't require us to particularly engage. I'm talking more like TV and even movies, I think, to some extent. Movies are more powerful, and now they're talking about virtual reality and so on. It's all kind of like confusing the natural relationships between our senses and the world that's out there. It's something intermediate that's getting in there and giving us a sort of prepackaged imaginative fling, you know? But I kind of agree with him. I think it's a problem. So a few other things I just wanted to say. We're not talking about rejecting the past in this model. You notice it circulates back into the past. Alchemically, you don't have anything to work with. I think your point was great. The negrido, that's what the raw material sort of that you have to work with is going to come from the past. That's what you have to work with. And so the past is important. We need to be informed by the past. That's different than being formed by the past. Another way of thinking about this is, are we creatures? You know, a creature is a creature, something that has already been formed. Or are we creative human beings? You know, there's a big difference there. The last thing I can't leave out, because we always need to talk about goddesses. And actually, there is a goddess that's very connected to alchemy, and that is Sophia. And she's called the goddess of wisdom. According to him here, she is also known as the soul of the world, which I think is an interesting expression. She's the soul of the world. She's the goddess of wisdom. In a way, the alchemist, she was sort of the goal in the sense that what they were trying to do by working their stuff with these substances that they were putting in there and cooking, they wanted to unconceal the wisdom that's in the world. It's hidden there. And what's hidden is the wholeness, the unity, the pattern. And that's all Sophia. The world is all around us, and it's in this multiplicity and diversity and incredible chaos almost. And yet there's a unity and a pattern there that's hidden, that's hard to see and all that, and that's what the alchemists were interested in, or one way of looking at what they were interested in, the wholeness, the unifying pattern, the self. That's what Jung would say, the self. Now, Sardello says about Sophia is that she's an interesting goddess because she's coming to us from the future. She's not one of the goddesses of the past. She comes to us from the future. And so she's about coming into being. And I'm going to end this part of the talk with another quote that he has about Sophia here. It's somewhat long, but I think it's good. This is a topic I would really like to know more about. Some of you may know about Sophia. I guess it's very central to alchemy. Anyway, this is what he says. Oops. Sophia may be characterized by a certain hiddenness that is not concealed behind something, but hidden precisely through the fact that she is revealed as the body of the world. When we observe the world in all its varied physical manifestations, a hiddenness nonetheless pervades everything, namely that all of this multiplicity of plant, animal, and human world is a totality, a unity. It all works together. Further, the totality that all works together does so in relationship with all the other planets, the moon, the sun, and the constellations of the zodiac. And there is yet another hiddenness, and this is very important to the alchemists. This unity binds to itself the particularity of every human soul in individuality. So there's a connection between the soul of the world and the individual soul. All this considered together is what is indicated by Sophia, wisdom, the soul of the world. And then he goes on, thus, beginning in the way we have with the question of the soul of individuality inevitably takes us into the soul of the world. The two are inseparable. Since, however, individuality is not something that is completed, but is coming to be, and I think for individuality, you could pretty much take individuation, but he's using the word individuality here. Since, however, individuality is not something that is completed, but is coming to be, the first thing we can say concerning the world soul is that she also is coming to be. Sophia differs from any other goddess image. She is not comparable with the Great Mother or Gaia, because she is a spiritual outpouring that is from the future, not the past. Sophia is a becoming, not a has-been. Yes, I mean, you could say that. Yeah, and it's like the world is individuating then. Yeah. Well, I'm going to stop there. I have a little more I could say about memory that we could do afterwards, or we can have questions, and we'll decide after the break.
So let's say that in 15 minutes, our bookseller said that...
I agree. Terry is a good presenter. Well, at this point, how long do we have, Paul?
We have till 9:30, and okay. You can basically use that time whichever way works with you.
Okay. Well, I have just a little bit more that I could present to you that is sort of honing in specifically on memory, which I talked a little bit about at the beginning of my talk, too. That wouldn't take too long, so maybe I'll go ahead and share that. It's probably only taking 5 minutes or something, and then we can just be open for any kind of questions or whatever after that. I was actually wanted to do the entire talk on memory, but I started reading different things, and I went to a conference that was this last Saturday that was about trauma and memory, and I read these articles and read things in here about memory and so on, and I couldn't. I got confused. But one thing that did come out of this for me was sort of saying, okay, well, let's look at, just look at memory and sort of look at what's healthy and what's not healthy. What's functional and what's not functional regarding memory. And I'm really here talking about memory in a maybe a little bit restricted way, because Sardello really gets into memory, and he talks about memory as the recollection of the whole of creation in the human body. I can grasp that a little. And then he says that, for example, if you look at the human body,
you have a head. We have lots, but you could think that there's three very obvious parts: the head, the heart, and the limbs. And so the head, the soul quality of the head, according to him, is the capacity that we have to comprehend wholes. The heart is the part that's very connected with imagination and in the service of creating, and in that sense, creating a future, the heart. And then the limbs is great. That's the action. You know, that's what helps us move. But getting down to a little bit more mundane idea of memory, some of the comments I'm going to make came out of learning some about the kind of problems that traumatized people have and the sort of way that memory shows up for them. This is a hot topic right now. The really hot topic I'm not going to talk about, which is the whole issue about the false memories, and I'm sure you've heard something about that. False memories of abuse and all this stuff. I think from a point of view of a therapist, some of that really misses the point, because, you know, memory has imagination in it, and memory is not a literal reconstruction of something in the past. That's actually very pathological. Any memory like that is very pathological, really. It's not normal at all. And from the point of view of the soul, the issue about whether it's true or not true is perhaps not near as important as, does it work or doesn't it work? Is it healthy or isn't it healthy? So the whole thing about, you know, is it true or is it not true, it isn't of great significance to me. I can understand certain legal situations and so on where they're trying to pin down, quote, facts. Maybe it's different. So here's one idea. You all the time, when we're in a creative process, we need to accurately assess our current reality. So do your memories help you accurately? Does a memory help you accurately assess your current reality, or does it block you? So that would be a distinction. Healthy memories would help you accurately assess your current reality. And if you have a memory of being abused, physically abused, and that is not well integrated in you, and that just shows up, actually, what that may show up in is that in order to protect yourself, you don't want to see things that remind you of getting abused. Which may mean that you don't want to see that the person that you're with is abusive. So that really is dysfunctional, that part. And this happens. We now know that traumatized people, especially traumatized in childhood, their capacity to be really in the world and to sense what's going on, to be in touch with other people, has been impaired. And that's one of the reasons that they get repeated abuse situations, is because they actually don't have the capacity to sense what's going on. Which I think is a lot of a different perspective on it than some that I might have had in the past, which is, you know, you wonder why people do this. But if you think, gee, they do this because they actually don't have the capacity to sense, you know, what's going on with other people. I think it puts a different light on it. Another thing about memory is the ideal way for memory to be is that you access it when you want to access it. If memories come in your face, this is not very functional. And this happens to traumatized people. They will have nightmares would be an example of repeating over and over a particular traumatic scene. It's just right in your face. They can't stop it. That's not functional. The other thing is that memory is an integrative function. It takes what we experience and integrates it into our ego, really. And of course, that's a mixed blessing. It helps us on one level because we're able to incorporate our experience, and but it also might get in the way frequently because we reduce everything down to what we experienced before. So I always do this, it's maybe not fair, but I don't even know if he said it, but supposedly Ronald Reagan said, once you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all. That's a pretty dysfunctional memory, in my view. It would like cut you off from experience, like you'd never want to look at another redwood, because you thought, I've got redwood now, you know, because I got this concept in my head, or I have this. Lots of other people besides Reagan do this, including me. So I'll not make it as a criticism of him. So there's that issue about memories that are very fragmented and memories that are unified. There's also the interesting thing about story, because most of us, our memories are embedded in stories. I mean, when we're recalling something that happened to us, it's now turned into a narrative story. And when we think about it, about what happened in the past, we don't suddenly have, under normal circumstances, if you're thinking about the lunch you had with somebody a few days ago, you might think, oh, the food was good, I really enjoyed being with them, and we talked about so-and-so and so on. But you don't immediately go back into the experience and see what you saw when you were sitting there and so on. I mean, that would be strange. Occasionally, if you have an experience that's intensely, it arouses you, it's very, but it's good, it's a positive thing, then it might be in your memory a little like that because of the arousal level, and it might show up for you like you get to smell the smells that you had and so on, but it's not the normal memory. The other thing is that memories, this is a really interesting thing, I think, is that they are,
not a normal memory, and if it were fragmented and did fall into the parts of that, even if, whether it would be negative or positive, that's bad?
No. When I'm saying it's not normal, I don't mean it's bad. Yeah. It just is.
Yeah,
it's just that way.
Is there something about that kind of broken up into parts memory, which gets in the way?
No, I don't think it would be, because, you know, in a person that had a positive experience, I think they'd usually have a story, too. They'd just also have more direct sensory data also, but they'd have the story. The dysfunctional part is where they just have the sensory part of it, the literal memory, and they don't have, it's not connected to a story, it's just fragmented like that. It's not integrated into who they are. That's the dysfunctional part. Let me finish the list here. It's not that long, and then we can. So, memory could be, I don't know if this is quite accurate about a memory, but the issue here is about fixation. Yeah, I think it is. Some people have a memory of what happened to them as a childhood. And the memory that they have is the memory of a child of that age, and it has not modified. That's the way they remember it. That's not very functional. And most of us, and this is partly what psychotherapy is about in some sense, but we learned other ways too, is as we develop and as we change, our memories of things change too, and they lose the developmental fixation. So, and in fact, that's one of the tasks sometimes in therapy, is to help somebody be able to look at their past in a way that fits with who they are now. They're looking at it like they're a 7-year-old, and they're not a 7-year-old anymore. That's fixated. That's not a memory that's open it's not an open system. It hasn't been modified. Memory is not meant to be like some sort of permanent record of something there. Healthy memory is modified as the person changes, the memory changes. This is kind of an obvious one. If your memories, do they enhance your aliveness or do they shut down your aliveness? That's a good distinction. Same with, do they express imagination or do they shut off imagination? And this is a more physiological one. Is the memory in a physiology that's of good feeling, or is it in a memory, is in the physiology of terror or shame? And frequently traumatized people, that's one of the problems, is that they're carrying the memory in very unpleasant affects. So they're terrorized or ashamed, and then it's hard to function. And of course, what you try to do then usually is to shut that off, and then you're numbed. To shut that off, to shut off the affect channel, then you're numbed. And so that's very, you could say, non-functional memory. Basically, maybe some of you might have some other ideas about it, but those are just some thoughts I had in looking at that.
Good question. How do you create balance?
I just realized I haven't got this on. A balance between. That's a good question. I think that the memory helps you do that. See, that's a good one. Does your memory help you be in the present? Or does it hinder you being in the present? What do you think?
I think it can do either.
Uh-huh. And what I'm saying is, it like a way to look at that is like, is it helpful or not helpful in that sense? That's one way to look at it.
And I think that, I don't know, my guess is that addiction is memory that does not allow you to be in the present.
Uh huh.
Like addiction to perfection, addiction to, you know, organizations. I don't know, I'm playing with this.
Yeah. In traumatized people, addictions are very common, and they seem to be the way they distract themselves from, you know, you get your attention focused on something else, and you become all caught up in that, and then you don't have to think about something else that might be painful. And certainly, it would also keep you from being present, I agree. Well, yeah, I said that, I think. I said that if you're
it has no value in present day.
Oh, I wouldn't say it has no value.
Okay.
Because that's back to what do we have to work with? I mean, we have to distinguish here. It's so interesting because I think when we're talking about the soul, true and false isn't useful, and good and bad isn't useful. And so, I'm not saying it's just you, it's me too. So then we put in healthy and unhealthy, and you notice it's still in there. It's virtually impossible to get
the critical function that judges things as good and bad out of things. It is one of the most, that's why the Stones wrote the book about embracing your internal critic, or embracing your critic, because it's one of the very, very difficult parts of ourselves to deal with. So, you know, lots of people's memories, that's one of the ways they live. Like, the memory lives, and what it means is that I was bad, or they were bad. You know, and then that's...
Is there a negative
person? Yeah, right. Yeah. And, of course, that's not a useful way to hold a memory, but it's a common way to hold it. Yeah. 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 Yes?
Well, I'm sort of working with something. When you talk about healing, there's an implication that there's something that you need to be healed from. Or I suppose another way would be to call that an illness of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. A word that hasn't been used.
Right.
I was thinking in your schema here, the idea that an illness, what you think about the idea of the illness as something coming from the future into the present that has the possibilities of change.
Uh-huh.
Either a mental or physical, not to make the distinction, but mental, physical.
I think that's a very intriguing idea. Do you have any more you want to say about that? I think that's...
The whole concept of the idea that a lot of diseases now are supposed to be genetic. I mean, there's a gene for this, mm-hmm. there's a gene for that, and they're finding more genes than Levi's. But something has to trigger these genes in order to for this quote disease or illness whatever to express itself. So we carry around this whole genetic makeup that's literally full of these illness possibilities,
right.
But then something comes along, something
yes.
triggers that, and then you get it, you have your heart attack,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. You know, I don't have the answer
yeah.
to that. But I think it's the idea that it's dormant, it's in your future.
It seems possible to me. I mean...
I noticed that Whitmore's book is sitting out here, Healing and Alchemy, mm-hmm. which is some book that I've spent some time with, and his whole idea of illness as part of an archetype, that the only part that you can really get, because you can't see the other parts,
mm-hmm.
you have to get knocked off your horse in order to...
Yes. And the whole thing, I mean, I know that this isn't quite that, but symptoms that people have, like pains in certain parts of their body and so on, one of the things that's really interesting there is to see if you can translate that language, the language of the body, the pain here or the tension here or a certain feeling there, into something that the person can work with. And I'm sure that it could be the same with illness. That's just a little more complex because it's altered the structure of the body, presumably, in some way, if it's an illness. It's moved into a more dense form than just having the pain or something. But I would think that it's certainly, I mean, alchemical healing and transformation could... That's something to work with. And we need to, and we're starting to do that. I mean, unfortunately, medicine, which is, I mean, doctors are supposed to be the healing profession, but I think they've forgotten a lot about healing, and a lot of it is on attempting to suppress things. And then you don't look at things. You don't look like, well, is this person's life imbalanced? What's going on here? What does this mean that they have this? You don't look at that. You just say, oh, that's bad. Let's get rid of that. And it's limited. It's useful sometimes to save someone's life, but... Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And about that more, it's important to forget, to make room for new experiences.
Yes. Yeah, that's a whole... That's a whole interesting subject. Because there are people who traumatized people, again, frequently forget. But the problem there is that the dissociated from it, they're forgetting that it happened, but it's registered in their body. So they haven't really forgot it. On a one level, it's still there. But I agree with you, there's healthy forgetting.
That's tied to the issue, I think, of forgiveness. We often
yeah, yeah.
Forgive but not forget.
Yeah.
Person,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes.
How do you work the Sophia piece back into this? Because if Sophia is future, she is a memory of all the things that
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you're using the word all that is, but I sense that you mean by that all that is, including all that is possible. Yeah. So you're using that in a bigger sense. Yeah. Yeah. It's the rest of what you said. Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. 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 It's all possible creation. Because that opens up things. It opens up, I mean, when you think of hope and the possibility for healing, it's hard to get it without this, I think. So that would be saying it's hard to get it without Sophia. I mean, there's... Yes? Yeah.
I think I heard you said about that a little bit. You seem to imply that there's a way of being on the right side, and that would have to be equally. But I didn't hear what that looked like. I'm curious.
Well, how about like a visionary that has absolutely no grounding whatsoever in reality? You know? I don't know him, but yeah, so then they're spinning around here, you know. So there's something about this that you know, there's the grounding function here. If you don't have this side of it, then you're spinning off into worlds of fantasy and everything. Yeah. Well, so you got a few more minutes.
Uh-huh. So very goal focused without being able to
right.
Process.
Right. Yeah. Well, they circle here. If this is, I don't know if this is right, but they'd have their vision and then they'd forget vision and forget vision and forget. They wouldn't remember and they wouldn't be inquiring into anything, and that would be interesting, but possible. Well, any more questions? We're about at the end of our time, so this might be a good time to stop.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.